In the 80s, I moved from Boston to Baltimore to DC. It's when I learned to love the fabulous museums, especially art museums, in these cities. They were free, or almost free, and free was important in my 20s. I went whenever I had the chance, lunch hour with coworkers, with friends, family, but most often alone. I believed learning about art would make me a sophisticated, interesting person, a la Audrey Hepburn in My Fair Lady. Maybe silly, but like many young adults with difficult families, I was trying to avoid becoming like my parents. These days, we call it ending generational trauma. I wanted the difference to be obvious. I was young, insecure, without a clear path. In my 20s, I could not have told you a thing about emotional regulation, coping skills, how to love myself, or how to simply be. Some of you might be surprised what you don't learn in a challenging, dysfunctional family. I know I was. But of course, it's obvious now that I was searching for a way to calm anxiety. A safe, conflict-free, beautiful space helped. I returned to museums again and again because they provided some relief. Also, I just love art. I love finding connections in art, history, poetry, music, human beings. I love seeing how artists, musicians, and poets, or other writers, interpret their times, make something out of nothing, and give us new perspectives. Somewhere along this haphazard way, Mark Rothko became one of my favorite artists. I almost said poets, but I think he's both. Rothko was a Latvian-born American abstract painter. He's best known for his color-filled paintings that depict irregular and painterly rectangular regions of color. He produced hundreds of these from 1948 until his suicide in 1970. At a glance, they seem not only similar, but perhaps repetitive, redundant. Some of Rothko's critics found it easy to be dismissive about the creations. But these paintings are part of my meditation routine, and I believe their capacity to teach is endless. To me, they bring forth worlds. That some of us might not appreciate Rothko's work without an investment of time reminds me of how I sometimes interact with people. I am a 63-year-old introvert whose small talk comfort level is, well, it's not good. It has not improved. And so I kind of dread it and I rush through it. And it's not about you, it's about me. Okay. I'm thankful for those who have more ease and get the conversation going. Much like my experience with art, after spending time with people, I really enjoy them and believe their capacity to teach me something is endless. Brief connections can be wonderful, but connection really thrives when we invest time. The philosopher and writer Iris Murdoch cut to the heart of our reluctance to put in the effort to pay attention when she observed that love is the extremely difficult realization that something other than oneself is real. The poet J.D. McClatchy wrote, "Love is the quality of attention we pay to things." Do we all feel like paying attention is something we're not doing well these days? Much less bringing a quality of attention worthy of being called love? We're so busy. Aren't we at least sometimes justified in not being present? I'm going to share a short poem. If you know me, you were probably just wondering when I would work a poem into the sermon. It's called Hurry by Marie Howe. We stop at the dry cleaners and the grocery store and the gas station and the green market. And hurry up, honey, I say, hurry. As she runs along two or three steps behind me, her blue jacket unzipped and her socks rolled down. Where do I want her to hurry to? To her grave, to mine, where one day she might stand all grown. Today, when all the errands are finally done, I say to her, "Honey, I'm sorry I keep saying hurry. You walk ahead of me. You be the mother." "And hurry up," she says. "Hurry up now, darling," she says, looking back at me laughing. "Hurry, hurry," taking the house keys from my hands. First time I read this, it seemed like a poem about the guilt that adults feel when the example that they're setting for children falls short of the ideal. So I went back to see if there was something else, some other way to read it. And I now feel that the mom in the poem sets a shining example of how to rebel against the tyranny of adult responsibilities that try to take over everything, every waking moment. She chose to stop and focus on her daughter. Sometimes our inability to be present reflects fears of not being accepted, not achieving enough, not being productive enough, not being enough. The mother possibly feared not getting everything done. She was investing her energy in clearing that list. This is a necessity of life. Work must somehow get done. Sometimes it must happen in a short time frame, and sometimes family and friends will be our hurried partners that day. Work and errands are part of a giant package of care we provide for our loved ones. There is absolutely invaluable presence here. Taking on these responsibilities is done in love, and it's one of love's highest forms. But sometimes it does conflict with other forms of presence. And today I want to focus on why we value making this pivot to another kind of attention and how this other kind of presence is life-altering for ourselves and for the world. Like the mother in the poem, we can see the gift of a moment dropped from heaven, see an opening for the practice of presence, but it's only a gift if we open it. Thich Nhat Hanh, a Buddhist monk and peace activist, wanted us to remember that we carry this great resource within us, our deepest well of power, our greatest antidote to fear, and the quality of love we give through the quality of our presence. He said, "When you love someone, the best thing you can offer that person is your presence. How can you love if you are not there? Come back to yourself, look into their eyes and say, 'Darling, you know something? I'm here for you.' You're offering them your presence. You're not preoccupied with the past or the future. You are there for your beloved. You must say this with your body and with your mind at the same time, and then you will see the transformation." So let's groove on that. Let's put that in our muscle memory, in our deliberate anxious action bank. Can you say after me, "I offer presence. I offer my presence. I offer the presence of my body and my mind at the same time.
I offer the presence of my body and my mind at the same time."
The transformation in Howe's poem happens when the mom offers her presence, a different sort of presence than was available to her earlier in the day. That's generosity and transformation. The child becomes hilariously creative, at once amusing and teasing her mom, making the joke, "Hurry, darling," transformation. The child is laughing, the mother is probably laughing too, and the fear, the fears and drudgery of the day of errands begin to lift from their shoulders. That's transformation and interdependence. Reflecting off each other, both moods and bodies ease. Their day of errands, their future interactions, all are transformed in this lighthearted moment because love. We sometimes bring impossibly dreamy and miraculous expectations to the word transformation. We want immediate change, instant gratification, ice cream, and world peace. It's important to remember that transformation is just as miraculous as it builds over time, as we invest over time. It's world-changing to make someone's life a little bit easier for even a moment. It's transformative to love. We feel a breath of relief when the mother and child share this moment because we know from experience, such memories are foundational to relationships. The day suddenly felt easier. We've been that adult on that day, opening ourselves and learning from what or who or whom we allow in, moving forward from that interlude with a new spring in our step, transformed. I have been transformed by Rothko's art. I now see complex meanings in the layers of paint and color fields that Rothko built, the different ways the rectangles break away and into each other. I see in the genius and humanity of Rothko's life and work, his longing to communicate, joy, despair, ecstasy, tragedy. These were the four main themes he sought to express in his luminous art. If I dedicate time and open my heart, bringing presence of body and mind, I find many of these same treasures and tragedies and see them anew in washing dishes, in friendships, in small talk, in the work recap told at dinner, in my mom's umpteenth retelling of a story she loves to share. Art teaches us to slow down and engage with what's right in front of us, to bring an open mind and receptive soul, to be still yet responsive. Art and poetry reward looking again and again, and often we're overcome by the joy of some new discovery. Something resonates, and our thinking evolves and deepens. From art and poetry, I've learned that whenever and however possible, I must remember to rebel against becoming a 21st century automaton. I must bring my entire mind and body to the moment in front of me. To paraphrase Iris Murdoch, love is the extremely difficult realization that something other than one's to-do list is important. Being in the moment, being fully present, allows me to share my authentic self. It grounds me so that I can access and share Unitarian Universalist values of love, interdependence, generosity, and transformation. Being present allows me to really see and hear the person in front of me and to bring better focus to the work in front of me. The payoff is so rewarding, I want to strive to make it happen more often. Though we know that being only human, we will have to be reminded to rebel. We will have to remind ourselves to be present time and time again. Sometimes, we lose our connection with being fully present after only a few moments. When this happens, put your hand on your heart. Dear humans, take a breath. We're doing great. The writer Ian McGilchrist says, "The world we experience, which is the only one we can know, is affected by the kind of attention we pay to it. The choice we make of how we dispose our consciousness is the ultimate creative act. It renders the world what it is. It is therefore a moral act. It has consequences." We see this truth laid bare in what particular injustices we choose to witness and address, or ignore and thus dismiss. We see it in our overwhelm at the information available to us and the challenge of knowing how to engage and affect positive change. I don't want this to be a sermon on what kind of unfortunate world I might be building when I am preoccupied and cannot show up with mind and body. But we do worry that we lack power to affect change, don't we? We are understandably unsure about where to even begin in a world that seems to spin a million miles a minute, slipping through our hands in oh so many wrong directions. But our presence and our witness are how we find our power and understand and face our fears. The practice of presence is the surefire way we enrich our lives and the lives of those around us. To paraphrase McGilchrist, how we engage with the world changes what we find there and governs the kind of attention
we consider it appropriate to pay in the future. And so it is that the world you recognize, which will not be exactly the same as my world, is firmed up and brought into being. Being more fully present is a springboard for change. By practicing presence, we can live our own lives more fully and in meaningful connection with others. By showing up with our minds and our bodies at the same time, we can change the world. Indeed, that's our best hope. We are our best hope. Mind and body at the same time, from muscle memory and from deliberate action. Maybe we all can think, let it begin with me. May it be so.